Hello and welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the role of nonprofits, social justice, activism, and charities. With me, your host, Ethan Clow. As always, we are broadcasting right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. It's on the radio dial as well as streaming live at CITR.ca. And of course, via podcast whenever, wherever, as technology permits. Well, everybody, welcome to the show. As I said, my name is Ethan Clow, your host. It is Friday, so good morning. I hope you're having a fantastic week and looking forward to an eventful weekend. This is also episode 60 of The Sector, and a bit of a sad note, this is our second last episode. Oh, how terribly sad. Oh, no, don't go. Anyway, the point being, of course, is that over the last, 60 or so episodes, we've managed to accomplish quite a bit here on the show. And as longtime listeners will know, this is something that I put a lot of energy and time into. And just given the fact that my schedule has increased in busyness levels of epic qualities, and also given the fact that as I, prepare each week for, every second week now, for a new show, there's a lot of planning, a lot of preparation that goes into it, and at the end of the day, it is a lot of work. It's like kind of like having an extra job for, half a week. So, as you can imagine, all of that extra stress and energy, I really need to reapply that elsewhere. Which is not to say that I don't really enjoy doing The Sector. I do. But, well, it's getting to the point now where it's starting to, it's time to move on to other projects. And as I mentioned a few weeks ago on the show, I'm not saying goodbye to radio. Of course not. No, I expect to have several other projects with CITR in the near future, or near far future. Well, we'll see how it goes, how things pan out and everything like that. But I do want to say, of course, it is a great pleasure to have you with us on our second to last episode. We have a lot of interesting things to talk about today. Interesting news going on in the social sector, related to social justice, but also related to one topic that we've touched on here on the show, and that is education. Recently, some information has come to light about UBC and their recent leadership snafu. So we're going to take a look at that a bit later on the show. We also have some updates on the militia, the occupying anti-government force that took up residency in a national park in the U.S. Things have turned a bit tragic, and it's worthy of some, I think, media skepticism to examine that and take a look at what the sort of dominant narrative has been going on right now. And then, in addition to all of that, I wanted to take a bit of time to talk about David Bowie. Now, of course, if you were paying attention to the news in the last couple of weeks, you knew that David Bowie passed away. A major artist, a major figure in music, fashion, movies, television, he did a lot of everything, was always well-known, respected, and much beloved for everything that he tried and did. And what's interesting, of course, is that shortly before his death, David Bowie released his last album. Obviously his last album, but it was intended to be his last album. So I thought we'd play a few tracks off that on today's show as a bit of a tribute, and maybe just kind of talk a bit about his impact on the world of media and pop culture. So lots to get onto on today's show. Before we get into all of that, of course, let's go for a quick commercial break here on The Sector. We will return after this.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the downtown area at
The Baker and the Chef, Bang On T-shirts, Beat Street Records, Dunlevy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattooing, Fortune Sound Club, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Perch, The Portside Pub, Save On Meats, and Vinyl Records.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
I imagined what it would be like to be a wizard, and then I pretended and acted in that way on the day.
Studies show that 9 out of 10 wizards prefer CITR 101.9 FM.
If we were to draw a graph of my process, of my method, something like this, Sir Ian, action, wizard, you shall not pass, cut! Sir Ian.
We are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clough, on CITR. Now, before we left off, we were talking a bit about David Bowie, who passed away a few weeks ago. Obviously, his impact on popular culture, on music, fashion, movies, everything that the man touched, basically, he left an indelible mark. In a lot of ways, you know, you kind of think of David Bowie, he was one of those people in the 70s and 80s and 90s. Well, I mean, his whole thing of sort of defining what it was to be like a rock star in the 70s and then kind of reinventing himself over the 80s and the 90s and doing all kinds of interesting artistic stuff. In a lot of ways, he was kind of like the impact that the Rolling Stones or the Beatles had on the 60s. And you can kind of even sort of see the parallels there as well when you sort of think of someone like Elton John, who is sort of the Beatles to his Rolling Stones, or vice versa, depending on how you want to look at it. Anyway, I thought it was really interesting when he passed away, and there was a lot of, you know, talk on the radio and a lot of tributes coming in. And I remember driving into work on the morning, after he passed away in the evening of the previous day. And so I'm looking through the radio and I'm listening, and I'm hearing all kinds of, you know, tributes, people talking about him, talking about his impact. What was interesting to me, though, was that not one radio station played any of the music off his new album. And it just kind of made me think, you know, because for someone who was so influential on music, and for someone who had, you know, David Bowie had a lot of Canadian connections. He worked with a lot of Canadian producers. He worked with a lot of Canadian bands. He had Canadian talent on his albums. So there's no shortage of, like, Canadian-connected David Bowie stuff. Not to mention some huge classics, of course. And yet, there really wasn't any effort to play the new stuff, the things that he had intentionally left behind as his legacy. And that really, shocked me. And I guess we can kind of chop that up to the fact that, you know, commercial conventional radio is not exactly the place to go when you want to see something new and exciting. It's more about kind of playing the same old, the top 40 hits that always sort of get the same kind of reaction, which is disturbing because for someone like David Bowie, you want to celebrate the fact that he knew that he was going to die pretty soon, and he wanted to leave something to his fans and to the world, and he wanted to create something artistic, and he put a lot of effort into making this last final album, and to not play any of these songs off it for, you know, the radio stations that were taking time out of their broadcasts to talk about David Bowie, I thought was kind of shallow. So I wanted to correct a little bit of that. I know that it's been a few weeks now, people are kind of moving on from this, but I thought, you know what, never mind. This is The Sector, damn it. We play whatever we want. So I'm going to play a few tracks off David Bowie's most recent album, and of course you can find this online at Amazon.ca or iTunes or wherever you go to get your music, you can find it. And just have a listen. Some of these tracks are really, they're very vintage Bowie, and they're kind of weird, they're kind of awesome, and let's just take a few minutes here on the show. We'll enjoy some of the artistic creativity of David Bowie.
Heaven. I've got scars that can't be seen. I've got drama, can't be stolen. Everybody knows me now.
Ha!
That was Lazarus by David Bowie off of his final album, Black Star. Now, I was actually going to play the title track, but it's like 10 minutes long, which is not to say that it's not a great track. It really actually is pretty awesome, but 10 minutes is kind of a long time for a show that doesn't usually play music. But again, I mean, like, you know, you listen to that song and you can just kind of see that there's no drop in quality. He's still producing amazing stuff. And again, it just kind of hits home that it's unbelievably sad to lose an artistic talent like that. Anyway, let's play one more song here off of Black Star, David Bowie's last album.
Trying to
That was Dollar Days by David Bowie off his final album, Black Star. A fitting conclusion to an amazingly artistic career. So I encourage you to go check it out. You can find it on Amazon.ca or iTunes, wherever you find your music. Some amazing tracks and just a great way to appreciate some really incredible music. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break here on The Sector. We'll return after this with some more. Stay tuned.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlach, Chairman.
We all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people. So check out the real deal on The Jazz Show at CITR 101.9 FM or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.
We're back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, discussing the world of nonprofits, social justice, and activism. Now, that little bit of music that you just heard was from, of course, Game of Thrones. You might say, well, why was that there? Is it because that Game of Thrones has become one of the most pirated TV shows of all time? Well, yes, it is. In fact, I wanted to talk about that because, again, we've mentioned piracy on this show many times, debating sort of the ethics and the various dilemmas that go along with piracy. Game of Thrones, for the fourth year in a row, has taken the, I guess, dubious honor? I don't know. Is that a good honor? Of being the most pirated TV show on the internet. In second place was The Walking Dead, followed by The Big Bang Theory. I don't know. Something about ironic about that. I just, whatever. But anyway, Game of Thrones. So, fourth year in a row, with an estimated 14.4 million downloads via the BitTorrenting. In 2015, the season finale beat the competition by a landslide. And I mean, that's, you know, not to be all that unexpected, of course. What's interesting, I think, of the whole piracy thing for Game of Thrones is that HBO's initial, like, very early reaction was kind of like, oh, that's nice. But then it kind of started to shift after a little bit, and it became more about, okay, well, we need to start protecting our property here. We need to start making sure that people are paying to get their Game of Thrones fix. And that, interestingly enough, led to a lot of conversation about the idea of, could there be something like a tip jar that you just, you know, put your change into just to get your Game of Thrones? And I think, you know, that whole conversation, that was kind of a pipe dream maybe, you know, 5-6 years ago. Well, now, of course, HBO is totally dived into the whole, you know, paying as you go format. Now, how successful it is and how it compares to things like Netflix is up for debate. But the fact is, HBO has kind of figured this out a little bit and is now trying to create ways for you to legitimately get Game of Thrones without having to get the rest of their channel, which is, you know, from a business model standpoint, may seem foolish or really clever. Time will tell how that plays out. But what's interesting, of course, with all kinds of piracy, what we've learned about over the years is that when something is not easily accessible, it increases piracy. When something becomes easier to get your hands on, even if you have to pay money for it, piracy goes down. So having Game of Thrones locked behind this, you know, massive paywall that is HBO, that means it's very hard to get a hold of. So piracy will naturally be extremely high. But if someone can say, well, if I just wanted to get only Game of Thrones off of HBO, I don't have to worry about any of that kind of illegal downloading stuff, well, then I'm going to go for that, because that's all I really want is Game of Thrones. I don't want to watch reruns of The Sopranos. So we'll see how this plays out. What another kind of interesting factor, of course, that goes along with this is the way that piracy can also help popularity. So I think it was Neil Gaiman actually made a very compelling argument that piracy has actually helped him make more money by making his things freely available, his books and comics and whatnot. He's actually experienced better sales of future products. So, and this is actually kind of an interesting way of transitioning for something like HBO. If people watch Game of Thrones and they like it, and they go, wow, look at the quality, look at what I can expect from these people, and then they start saying, okay, maybe I should get HBO, and I'll get to see all these other great shows that they put a lot of time and effort into. You can make the argument that shows like The Sopranos or Rome, which was also really popular, did that as well. It helped people kind of get on that bandwagon. Look at Netflix. Especially the popularity of things like Daredevil and Jessica Jones. Clearly, that has turned some heads. And I bet you that wouldn't have happened if not for piracy helping people find those things. Someone who's only a fan of Marvel, for instance, pirating Jessica Jones or Daredevil is going to go, whoa, I didn't realize Netflix had this level of quality. And they're going to be much more likely to subscribe to Netflix. And again, that's what they want, of course, right? The subscription. So in that case, piracy, maybe not so bad. Of course, this is all just intellectual throwing paint at a wall and seeing if it sticks type conversation. I just wanted to point that out because I think it was very interesting. And we've talked about piracy before in the past. But let us shift away from the talk of Game of Thrones and killing kings and bringing chaos to empires, and talk about the totally unrelated theme of UBC having difficult times with their then president. Did you see what I did there? That little transition? That was actually really... Okay, whatever. Moving on. Recently, some documents were released talking about UBC and the friction between the board and their former president, Arvind Gupta. Now, originally, UBC released this information with a lot of the details redacted. However, due to a mistake, they also revealed everything else. So, as you can imagine, a lot of people who are close to the university and keep a close eye on this sort of thing immediately started going through all of these emails, all of these documentation, these memos, documenting and chronicling the very extreme form of conflict that was growing between UBC's upper leadership. Gupta was hired by UBC with considerable fanfare in 2014, and it was sort of seen as he was going to be a real kind of changing of the guard and represent some major shifts in terms of organizational structure for UBC. However, about 13 months into his service as president, he abruptly resigned and left a lot of people kind of going, what? And we've starting to learn just from these documents that have come out, some willingly and some accidentally, that there was a lot of friction and a lot of divisive rhetoric going on behind the scenes at UBC, Which you might say, well, why would, you know, why is this relevant? And I think that aside from sort of the kind of, you know, gossipy drama that some people are reporting on, this is actually a really good indication of, or rather a really good look at the importance of leadership. You know, we often, I think, get a bit caught up in the idea that organizations, whether they be universities, nonprofits, charities, or government bodies, operate on the strength and labor of the people at the bottom of the food chain. And that, of course, is true to a certain extent, right? You can't have an organization that functions without your frontline fundraisers and social workers, the people who spend time organizing and running day-to-day operations of your enterprise. But that being said, we often, I think, neglect to consider the importance of leadership and how the leadership will filter down throughout the organization. Ultimately, setting an organizational culture comes from the top. It's one of those things that needs to be set and then acted upon. It, you know, the expression walk the walk, right? You have to make sure that your leadership represents the values that they proclaim to have, which is not always the case, as we have noted in previous episodes. When you look at some of the issues that were raised regarding Gupta's resignation and the response that he was getting from the board as well as the other, you know, chief executives of UBC, there really points to a dark and kind of nefarious subculture of distrust and sort of a failure of communication. So, for instance, looking at some of the memos themselves, I'll quote a few of them from the reports. Quote, to be completely transparent with you, we are still not certain that you fully appreciate the scope of your accountability, which was written by John Montalbano, the former chair of the university's board of governors. Quote, as president and leader, issues such as low employee morale on campus, the relationship challenges with your key stakeholders, and the simmering external reputational risks developing as a result of these challenges are fully yours to own. So, I mean, pointing at some pretty serious and leadership qualities that are lacking in their president there. To add a bit more to that, here's another quote from Montalbano. This may seem like overkill, but the board is very concerned that you may not fully appreciate the importance of formal governance in every aspect of your role. There is a general consensus that your actions and reactions to the board's concerns, advice, and inquiries suggest you possess an indifference or intolerance of the board at best, or worse, an intended disregard of its authority. And you might say, well, aside from kind of, again, the juicy gossipy side of this, though, there are some pretty serious implications when you have that kind of disconnect between your senior leadership. And as I was mentioning, we can often, again, get sidetracked and not really appreciate the impact of true leadership. How does it impact an organization? One of the things that I've experienced many times with the question of leadership is the way that a leader has to set both an example and you might even call it a template of the organization's culture. How that organization deals with external factors, internal factors, how it, in a way, deals with organizational stress, how it is able to handle conflicts and unexpected situations. I've been involved in organizations that have had extremely flexible leaders who have been adaptable in every sense of the word. And you might say, you know, what do they do on a day-to-day basis to make that happen? Well, that's hard to pin down exactly, but you can't deny, and I certainly couldn't deny in those situations, that the leadership that they've expressed, how they related to employees, and how they related their intentions and their vision down through boards, through executive council, through interaction and sort of setting the tone of this is what we want our organization to do and how to interact with our clients, our constituents, our donors, etc. That just carries on and it gets inside of you and you start to see things through that lens. So in a lot of ways, if you have a leader who is able to express that in a certain fashion, a sense of adaptability, a sense of organizational excitement, a notion that, okay, whatever comes our way, we're going to deal with it. We're not going to be overwhelmed. We're not going to take this and lose our heads. We're not going to panic, and we're not going to be defeated by setbacks. That kind of attitude, when it carries on, can really make an organization weather some pretty serious tests. If you ever had an organization where a donor is lost, a major gift that no longer comes through, changing economic factors, a recession in the economy, the loss of important members of your team for whatever reason, whether they retire or whether they get a new job, all of those things can set off chain reactions throughout nonprofits and charities that destabilize the entire organization. And we've all seen examples of this happen, right? We all know what it's like for an organization when they lose a key person and they get that brain drain where all of that stored knowledge that person had that wasn't written down anywhere is suddenly gone. And the people who are left behind are going, well, how do I even get started on this project? I don't even know where to begin. I don't even know the first steps because the person who's been doing this for like 10 years is now gone. When you have that situation happen, the organization can just go to pieces. I've seen it. And where a strong leadership role comes in is, and in a sense, almost providing guidance. It's you're standing back and you're saying, okay, your job's not on the line. We're not gonna close up shop. We're gonna survive. We're gonna weather this. And through that sense of confidence and that sense of, okay, let's carefully evaluate how we can move forward on this, that whole concept, that can get you through these crises. Now, what's interesting about the whole UBC situation is that it looks like that confidence had eroded to such an extreme point. One of the areas where I think leadership does really kind of demonstrate a difference between, you know, just sort of an executive chomping a cigar sitting in a big plushy leather chair and somebody who actually knows what they're doing is leaders are necessary to be sort of like a steering force for an organization. Now, one of the reasons why I said that your kind of day-to-day staff, your frontline people are pivotal to making an organization a success is because there needs to be dialogue between, you know, leadership and those people. You can't have leadership that either doesn't care, doesn't trust, or hasn't earned the respect of the people who are the frontline force of that organization. And again, I'm sure we've all seen examples of this where you get people who are out there day-to-day work doing, you know, what they think is best for the organization, and they either don't feel like they're being listened to, or they don't feel like their advice is being heard, or you just have a leader who kind of says, no, I know better than you, and keeps pushing them in a direction that they don't want to go. You get this kind of friction in the center, this disconnect, and that's where I would say the majority of organizational cultural problems happen is in that center where there's no dialogue. And again, if you've ever been in a situation with that happening, it's ugly. It's nasty to see. So it's, again, I think it really kind of highlights why you need both. You need people who are tireless, adaptable, and smart on the front lines. You need a leader who has a vision, but is also willing to engage and listen to their employees and ultimately evolve with what their employees are saying. And that's a tricky balance to have. Unfortunately, based on what we've seen from UBC, that just wasn't the case. So again, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out and what, you know, kind of the fallout will be and under the leadership of UBC. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of listeners right now who would say that this is the tip of the iceberg when it comes to UBC. Anyway, let's go for a quick commercial break. We'll come back with, the last bit of the show coming up after this. So stay tuned. See you in a few minutes.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we're back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clough. Now, a bit of a follow-up from 2 weeks ago when we were talking about the Oregon standoff between the anti-government terrorists who had occupied some federal park. So if you caught up on the news in the last little while, one of the militiamen was killed in a standoff with law enforcement. And, you know, again... Obviously, when someone dies, it's tragic, and in any circumstance, this was totally 100% avoidable. There was no reason this had to devolve to the point where someone was killed. That's just sad, it's sickening, and it's stupid. What I find interesting is the way that the media is talking about this. It's, on the one hand, it's strange, and on the other hand, it's borderline frightening. Let me expand on that. When this first started happening, I complained that there was a kind of juvenile style to the reporting on this event. These were people who were armed and who were basically promising violence if they were, approached by law enforcement. And throughout, you know, media, sort of mainstream media, but also in a lot of even like counterculture media, the response was to kind of label these people as sort of idiots, as kind of, you know, sack-jawed morons from The Simpsons or something like that, who were so stupid and so silly and dumb, and it was, you know, people were just like laughing at how silly and dumb they were. Which I think is kind of shocking, considering the U.S. and gun violence and what's been happening in the last little while. You know, you just think, like, if these people were black, primarily black protesters, armed themselves, how would the mass media portray them? You know, you can't even have a protest of predominantly black people without news reporters and people in the media calling them thugs and criminals and making sort of all sorts of judgments about... rap culture and hip-hop life and gangs and violence and drugs. And yet here you have people who are explicitly saying, we're here to kill somebody if we have to, with guns that we've armed ourselves with, illegally occupying land that's not ours. And you don't see that same level of rhetoric in the media anywhere. You don't see it from politicians. You don't see it from law enforcement. You don't see it in the news. It's completely different. It's completely absent. Likewise, I've noticed that the way that people, even I know, who refer to this, again, are kind of treating these people like they're cartoons or something. Like they're, you know, Yosemite Sam from Bugs Bunny. You know, I recall, and it happens from time to time, when, say, a group of Native protesters will occupy some place in the north, or, you know, like an oil refinery, or they'll block roads, that sort of thing. And you look at the public debate or the public level of discourse around those circumstances, and they're always obscenely violent. You know, oh, they should go up there and kill them, and, oh, you know, just run their trucks over them and whatnot. There's a different way that people are talking about these militiamen, terrorists, in my opinion, versus all the other forms of civil disobedience that we've seen that has been largely nonviolent. And why? What is going on here that has created this sudden and shocking change in the narrative? Because it's clearly not related to the level of danger, because these people clearly are dangerous. The fact that one of them was killed in a standoff with police is one thing. The fact that there are major security concerns regarding these people should be underlined repeatedly. Whereas, you know, an Occupy Wall Street protest or Black Lives Matter protest, they're calling in the National Guard. They're calling in the SWAT team. Why? What is happening here that there is this different level of approach for arguably an extremely more dangerous threat to public safety? And ultimately, I think it's something that we can ask ourselves. Why are we not having this conversation in a different way? Why isn't this conversation being mentioned? Why aren't people saying, hold on a second? Why are we so quick to label protesters at a Black Lives Matter protest or occupation as thugs and criminals and gang members? Whereas these people here, I mean, by definition, they are gang members. Gangs in sort of racist and supremacist movements. And yet, again, we refer to these people as characters of comic books and cartoons. It's really quite remarkable. Now, that, of course, is the narrative that we're getting out of media, out of the online discussions and news reports and etc. What's also interesting and telling in a lot of different ways is the response these people have earned from law enforcement. Now, you may get the impression that I was sort of suggesting that the FBI and the police go in there, guns a-blazing, and, you know, shoot them all, which is not what I'm suggesting at all. What I'm trying to point out, though, is that there is this extreme difference in approach between law enforcement in this situation and law enforcement in other situations. And I don't know if people are fully appreciating that difference as much as they should be. Law enforcement in this case, you might even say, has been exceptional, because the threat of violence was so high, the circumstances to allow violence to break out is extremely high. You have armed people who essentially are saying, we want to fight, and you have law enforcement sort of standing back and saying, okay, we're going to stand over here, we're going to wait for you to calm down a little bit, then we're going to talk. And the fact that you've had one death, which is tragic, but you think about how this could have gone down, and that one death is starting to look pretty remarkable. But think about all those situations where this approach was needed for other circumstances. You look again at the the Occupy protests. You look again at the Black Lives Matter protests. All of the protests over the fact that you had police officers committing acts of violence against people in the U.S., most specifically young black men. And you look at the protests that went on in Baltimore and other places, and the violence that erupted. You had SWAT teams and tear gas and tanks. Where was that here in Oregon? Why was that response so dramatically different? Why were they so willing to engage and put themselves in positions where violence was likely to explode in those circumstances, but so hesitant in this circumstance? Even though, clearly, they had the right idea to not escalate the situation, and they should be commended for not doing that and possibly saving many, many, many lives. But why weren't they doing that in those other circumstances? Why wasn't that level of restraint shown in other circumstances? And why isn't the media talking about that and saying there is a big difference between how this hate group is being treated compared to how all these other protests and civil disobedience is being treated elsewhere? It's really important to examine that, I think. So, as we are running out of time here on The Sector, I really want you all to think about that, and feel free to send your thoughts to me. You can email me at sectorpodcast@gmail.com, and of course, you can tweet at Ethan Clow, that's me, also on Facebook, facebook.com/sectorpodcast, and let me know. Maybe you have some thoughts you want to share, and if you get them in quickly enough, I may be able to respond on our last episode ever of The Sector, which will be in 2 weeks' time. So, as we are wrapping things up, I want to say thank you all for tuning in to our second-to-last episode. That's so sad. But, nevertheless, bigger, better things on the horizon. You know the drill. No need to be sad here. Thank you all for tuning in. We will see you in 2 weeks' time. And I hope that you are enjoying our final wrap-up episodes of The Sector. See you all very soon. Stay tuned on CITR for more amazing, awesome content coming up right now.